Jim, Willie, Cynthia, Ross, Martin, Shirley, Jill. Come on, let's go. Let's get this club meeting started. How many clubs have you belonged to in your life? There are so many different kinds of clubs. There's Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, bass fishing, bowling, and bridge clubs, Lions, Kiwanis, and Rotary and Junior League, investment clubs, Toastmasters, sales and marketing executives, and dozens more. Most clubs have membership requirements, and so does this club that you should consider joining if you're not already a member. It's a sales club. I call it the Top 1% Club. Oh, you won't find it listed in any directory. It exists only in the minds of truly great sales professionals. I'll be telling you more about joining the Top 1% Club as we go on in this message. But first, I'd like to ask you to think back to your beginnings as a salesperson. When did your sales career begin? How good were you when you first started? Who influenced you and helped you improve and grow? Who has influenced your life and your career the most? Well, as a full-time corporate seminar leader since 1974, working with many Fortune 1000 corporations, over 1,628 corporate seminars under my belt as of this moment, I can tell you that I've met lots of people, presidents of billion-dollar-plus corporations, politicians, athletes, movie stars, the famous and the not-so-famous. But out of all those people, relatively few of them have significantly influenced my life and my career. Who has influenced your life and your career the most? You might want to make a list of the top five or six. You know, the idea of making a top five list came to me at a seminar that I was attending, where the presenter suggested that we go home that night and write down the five most positive influences in our life. Amazingly, a few people in the room already had such a list, but I didn't. So that night, I made my list. The number one most positive influence in my life has been my wife, Judy, my best friend, business partner, and mother of our two wonderful and now grown and married daughters. Judy and I met way back in 1959 when she was just 15 and I was 17. And we got married in 1963. Now, that's a long time ago. And we've had a great marriage all these years. Next on my list was my mom, Frances Weldon, a one-of-a-kind thinker and a hard worker who raised me as a single mom and as an only child, surrounded me with love, and taught me the joys of hard work and paying attention to the little things. Who would be number one and number two on your list? Well, they need to know it, so tell them before it's too late. Call them or write them and let them know how much of an impact they've had on your life. Well, third on my list was Earl Nightingale, the man whose ideas helped me change my life in 1967 when I heard his legendary recording, The Strangest Secret. Earl has since passed away, but his ideas continue to live on for the millions who still listen to his life-changing words of wisdom as the dean of personal motivation. Number four on my top five list of most positive influences is a wonderful man by the name of Vernon Cavill, my first sales manager. Vernon is the man who introduced me to the Earl Nightingale messages when I was struggling to learn to sell, and he gave me that recording of The Strangest Secret. Vernon and I have remained in touch all these years. You'll hear from him later on this series on just how poorly I did when my sales career began. So if you're struggling, yes, there's hope. I know. Because if I could learn to sell after making just one sale out of my first 1,200 sales calls, then almost anyone can. And now number five, the fifth greatest positive influence in my life and career was Mr. Willie Cooley, that taxi driver from Memphis, Tennessee. Why? Because he was such a role model. Willie showed me in just 22 minutes how to make a positive impact on others, a lasting positive impact. I won't forget his enthusiasm, his energy, his joy, the uniqueness he brought to his work, and the way he got repeat business. And most of all, I won't forget his ability to be so focused on his customer and their needs that the time he spent with me was thrilling. That's what put Mr. Willie Cooley on my top five list, and that's what put him in the top 1% club. So what can you take away from the story of Willie and add to your own experience? Pick just one thing Willie did, a principle, and add it to your own selling. And then look for your own Willie Cooleys from people who sell you or provide you with a service. Learn and grow from being the customer. Now let me share with you what I did within 24 hours of meeting Willie. As I told you, I wrote down in specific detail what he said and what he did, and the 12 specific things that impacted me in that 22-minute taxi ride. then I immediately put some of the ideas into action. After attending the evening reception with Federal Express, where I met a lot of the people who would be in my audience the next morning, I returned to my hotel room and refocused my message and my material, even more specifically on them, my customers, even more than I usually did. And that extra 2 hours of preparation increased my ability to present a seminar that was even more on target. Then the next morning, instead of sitting in the front row, right up near the stage like I used to do before being introduced, I went to the back of the room and waited till the introduction was finished. Then I walked very quickly, actually I jogged, right down the center aisle and leaped onto the stage, just like Willie leaped out of his cab. That enthusiastic opening really got the attention of the audience, and it got me jump-started too. Next, I just stood looking at the audience of a few hundred people and smiled. A giant Willie Cooley smile, but with teeth. No words, just a smile for a slow count of three. One, two, three. Then I said, "Welcome to this exciting and idea-filled seminar," just like Willie welcomed me to Memphis at the airport. Just doing those three little things, preparing even more, leaping onto the stage with enthusiasm, and smiling bigger, made a real difference in the first impression I made on my customer, the Federal Express audience. Now, decades later, I not only still do that, I also incorporated the other nine lessons Willie taught me on that January day. And the fact that so many years have gone by since that encounter with Willie, well, that really adds credibility to the power of Willie's example. You know, if I had just met him last week and then told you a 22-minute taxi ride impacted my life, how would you or I ever know how lasting that impact would be? But the test of time really does validate a concept, a technique, or an idea. And those time-tested ideas are what made Mr. Willie Cooley a charter member of the Top 1% Club. Selling is a science. So when you're in the role of a prospect or buyer, study selling. There are rules to the science, and the more you know about these rules, the more sales you'll make and the more people you'll help. As a science, selling requires hard work and dedication. Almost all things are difficult before they become easy. But when you bring these qualities to your work, your results become predictable. So how predictable are your results? What's your closing percentage? How much preparation time do you invest in each presentation? Almost all professionals invest time preparing. Lawyers spend up to 25 hours preparing for every hour in front of a jury. And advertising people prepare 150 hours or more for every 30-second commercial. As a professional speaker, I invest 50 hours in preparing for every 4-hour seminar for my audiences. Yet one recent study showed the average salesperson invests less than 30 minutes a day preparing for that day's presentations. How much time do you invest preparing for your clients, prospects, or customers? In addition to the time you invest in preparing, it's important to focus on the time you spend actually selling. A study that was done by Dartnell called Salesforce Selling Activity Survey was startling. Now, of course, the survey covered many different industries and types of salespeople, but the message is clear as you look at these numbers. Based on the average salesperson's work week of 46 and a half hours, here's how that time was invested by those who were surveyed. Here, let me read it to you. 5.6 hours was spent servicing customers or answering service questions. 7 hours doing paperwork or working on their computer. 8.5 hours traveling and waiting. 11.5 hours on the telephone. 13.9 hours face-to-face selling, or 29% of the work week. So what's your percentage? Well, one way is to keep a time log for 1 week and find out. Or invest in a stopwatch with an accumulating minute and hour dial, the kind used to time long events like marathons and triathlons. I did this years ago in my sales career. A dry spell had hit me, and I was in a slump. And then I remembered what Vernon Cavill had told me. When you hit a sales slump, figure out how much time you're actually spending selling, face-to-face with your prospects. Well, I did that, just as Vernon had suggested, with a stopwatch in my pocket. I'd start at the moment I met a prospect and began my sales presentation, and then as soon as I left, I'd stop the watch. Oh, I forgot to tell you this other critical part. Vernon said I had to put masking tape over the face of the watch on Monday morning when it was at zero, and not until Saturday night could I take the masking tape off. He said once you see how many hours of actual selling time you put in, divide that into how much you earned in commissions that week, and see if you're overpaid or underpaid. Well, I'm embarrassed to admit it. When I did that simple exercise of deterring my actual selling time for a week, it was no wonder my sales were down. I wasn't spending enough time in front of prospects. Oh, you want to know how many actual hours I'd spent selling in those 6 days of making sales calls? It was less than 7 hours. I had been saying to myself, I'm working 60, 70, 80 hours a week here. But this experiment proved that those were not 60 to 80 hours of productive selling time. That week, my approach to selling took a dramatic turn for the better, and I stopped kidding myself. What counted was not just hours, but productive hours. So when you find yourself in a slump, check out your actual selling time. It might just shock you like it did me. Next, don't compete, create. Find out what everybody else is doing, and then don't do it. Be totally unique. Dare to be different. Avoid playing copycat with your selling strategy. Approach your profession in a way that sets you apart from others, like Willie did. Being creative is a learned skill, and creativity is something you can develop. As an example, let me tell you about another charter member of the Top 1% Club. Now, I've never met him, and most likely you haven't either, but you know who he is. He was born on June 27, 1930. His selling career began at the age of 7. When he sold Christmas cards and garden seeds in Texarkana, Texas. And at the age of 12, he sold newspapers. After high school, he went to Texarkana Junior College. That was all his parents and he could afford. And then he was accepted by the U.S. Naval Academy. After graduating in 1953, he served 4 years of active duty at sea on a destroyer and an aircraft carrier. After the Navy, he got married and was hired by IBM's Data Processing Division as a salesman. Now let's stop here. I mean, so far, this could be anybody's story. Poor boy, works hard, gets an education, serves his country, marries his sweetheart, gets a job, and lives a life of quiet desperation. Well, millions do, but not this young man. He had a different approach. He decided not to conform to the majority or to live his life in quiet desperation. Here, let me read you in his own words how he approached his selling career. I quote, "I was always thoroughly prepared. Most salespeople aren't. If you've done your homework, the customer will be impressed that you know what you're talking about. And you just have to keep making those calls. That's the important thing. Some of the biggest sales I've ever made took 2 or 3 years. You can't package successful selling. You can't write a recipe for it. You do whatever it takes to win. The problem is that most people are too fragile to go on with it." He went on to prove his feistiness and his lack of being fragile. He became the target of almost every late-night talk show comedian and mimic across America. This little man with a squeaky, scratchy, almost annoying voice named Ross Perot. That's right, the 1992 presidential candidate who earned 19% of the U.S.'s popular vote, the billionaire founder of EDS, the same man who in 1979 directed a successful rescue mission of two of his employees being held hostage in Iran. He got them out safely, and so dramatic was their rescue that a book, Wings of Eagles, and a TV miniseries was made about this event. And he was the man who helped found and finance the Reform Party in America. No matter what you might think of him politically or personally, Mr. Ross Perot was one terrific sales professional. Let me explain why. As one of IBM's top salespeople, Ross was causing problems in his Texas territory. What kind of problems? Well, he was earning too much money, and his managers didn't like it. Ross said, let me quote him, "Selling IBM computers in the early 1960s was like selling umbrellas in the rain. All I did was work hard all day long, every day." So when his sales manager said he was making too much money, Ross said, "Okay, if it'll make you happy, pay me less for everything that I sell. But let me just stay busy. I just can't stand not being busy." So they came up with a new sales plan just for Ross. He would be paid 1/5 of what everybody else at IBM got. Now, can you imagine that? Here's your number one sales pro doing so well, management decides to cut his income. Well, Ross got mad, and he said, let me quote him again, "I had been in that territory for 4 years. At this point, I had farmed it like an orchard. So I said to myself, well, okay, that's the game they're looking to play. I'll bring in all my trees." Well, that sounds like vintage Ross Perot. And you know what he did? From January 1st to January 19th of that year, he sold his entire annual sales quota. He explained it this way. "While sitting in my barber's chair over the Christmas holidays, I read a line in the Reader's Digest by Thoreau that said, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. So I said to myself, Ross, there I am. So I decided to quit and do it on my own. And with that decision made, in the next 3 weeks, he went out and sold his entire annual quota and then quit. With his wife Margot's help and their 5 kids' support, he started his own one-man data processing company called Electronic Data Systems and soon built it into a corporate giant with over 70,000 employees. Not long after, he sold EDS to General Motors for $2.5 billion. Not bad for a 7-year-old Christmas card sales boy from Texarkana, Texas. Now, what does that story tell you? Well, it tells you it's sure not what you look like that counts. It's sure not where you come from that counts. But what really counts is what you do with what you got. Willie sold transportation. Ross sold lots of tangible stuff, cards, newspapers, and computers. And both did what they did in a unique and innovative way. Both earned their membership in the top 1% club. So it's not what you sell, it's how you sell it. Okay, then. Let's say that you have an excellent knowledge of your product, its features and its benefits, and are quite qualified to present it because of the training provided by your company. You also know that professional selling is a learned skill. And as in most areas of education and skill development, there are many different teachers using many different languages. So that you and I can communicate on the same frequency, let's define a few terms. The term professional salesperson refers to an individual who has excellent skills to present a product or service to a prospect or to an existing customer or client. To keep things simple, we'll just use the word prospect, keeping in mind that for salespeople involved in account selling, a prospect could be a customer or a client who is called on regularly. Now, the term product or service refers to what you sell. And again, to simplify our discussion, we'll just use the word product. And this could be a tangible or an intangible product, a big-ticket item or a small one. It makes no difference. When I use the term close a sale or make a sale, this too needs some clarifying. In some cases, a salesperson actually gets a contract signed and collects full payment or a down payment right on the spot. In other cases, nothing is signed, no money changes hands, and yet the salesperson has still made a sale. This would be true in the case of a dealer-distributor relationship, or in a situation where you have an assigned territory and a customer has an account and a line of credit and would order products as needed. It would also be true in pharmaceutical sales, where a physician would prescribe a drug when a patient needs it, or in a construction or engineering situation where the salesperson calls on architects or engineers who would write those products into the specifications, and maybe a year later the winning bid contractor would place the order. Almost every product and service is closed in a different way. But you know in your own mind what you consider a successful conclusion to your sales presentation to be. Whatever that is, that's what we're calling closing the sale in this program. And because you're approaching your work as a professional, it's important to identify what stage of development you're at right now. And there are 5 stages. Now, this is a slightly different version of one that you've heard before. The first stage of development is the unconscious incompetent. That's a person who doesn't know that he doesn't know. Total ignorance. Most of us began there. Next is the conscious incompetent. The person who now knows he doesn't know. We can call this enlightened ignorance. Most of us have been there too, right? Now the third stage is the unconscious competent. It's doing it right without knowing what it is you're doing. It would be like a salesperson going out and coming back with the largest sale in the company's history. The sales manager, with great excitement, says, "How did you do it?" And the salesperson's reply is, "Well, I don't know. I just went out there and they bought it." It's awful tough to repeat something if you don't know what it is you did. And then we have the fourth stage, the conscious competent, knowing what it is you need to do to sell professionally. And when you make the conscious effort, you can do it. But the last stage of development is our goal. The fifth stage, the conscious, unconscious, competent. That means knowing that you know, doing what you know, but doing it automatically without even thinking about it. This would be where Willie Cooley and Ross Perot and nearly every other member of the top 1% club would fit in. Now, it's probably safe to say that when it comes to selling, you're not in either of the first 2 stages of development. You're beyond that. So which of the other 3 descriptions fits your current level of performance? The unconscious competent, succeeding not because you know what you're doing, but in spite of the fact that you don't. The conscious competent, doing it right, knowing it's right, but having to think about what you're doing. Or the ultimate goal, the conscious, unconscious competent, knowing that you know, doing it, and repeating it automatically. Probably less than 1% of all salespeople qualify for this illustrious group, and they make up the top 1% club. When you meet a conscious, unconscious competent, they just stand out. They're so special, and that's what makes them so successful. Good golfers say when they play golf with great golfers, their game improves. When ordinary professional basketball players have a superstar player on their team, ordinary players say their game is elevated. That superstar's mere presence increases the performance of his or her teammates. One such superstar in basketball was Cynthia Cooper. After playing on two medal-winning U.S. Olympic teams and 11 years as a pro in the European Basketball League, she got to play for the Houston Comets in the Women's National Basketball Association. She became the league's most valuable player, called by one of her teammates, and let me quote her, "the best professional basketball player I've ever seen. She's as good as Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, and Michael Jordan." Wow, I mean, that's pretty strong stuff. Well, from what I've seen and read, it was well-deserved. Now, the principle here isn't about basketball. It's about exceptional performance. Almost every sales organization has some sales superstar who stands out, leads the pack, and sets all kinds of records. Once you identify that person in your organization, study them. See if you can identify what they do and how they do it. They might not be able to tell you exactly what it is. They might not even know exactly what they do, but they do it. So see if you can go out in the field with them just to watch them sell. Or just ask them questions. Listen. Really listen when they speak at sales meetings. And remember, superstars aren't born superstars. Learning is a gradual process. It takes time to let go of the old unproductive behaviors and habits and form new, productive ones. I mean, take Cynthia Cooper. She didn't even know she wanted to play basketball until she was 16. Before that, she just ran high school track and played softball. Then one day in gym class, she saw an older girl coming down, dribbling the basketball down the court, put the ball behind her back from left to right, make a layup. "Wow," Cynthia said, "I want to play like that someday." And from that moment on, Cynthia studied the best, until one day, almost 20 years later, at age 35, she was the best. So who will you study and learn from so you can join the top 1% club? Sometimes you can learn from somebody you've only heard about, read about, or heard speak at a sales meeting. That's what happened to me at the third international sales conference I attended when I was a sales representative back in 1970. It was at the Palmer House in Chicago, and the speaker was Shirley Schmitz, a sales superstar who was asked to speak to the thousands of salespeople attending this international meeting from all over the world. Her talk was titled, "Drop Me in Dubuque." To this day, I remember it. It was so impacting. Plus, I wrote it down. And here's what she said in her opening statement. "Drop me in Dubuque, or any city in the United States, at 9 in the morning, and by 5 p.m. that evening, I'll have made at least one sale. No leads, no referrals, no centers of influence, no money, no support, no contacts, no help of any kind. Just give me a good product, and with my honest sales presentation and my self-confidence, I will sell." Wow. As I sat there in 1970, I felt just like 16-year-old Cynthia Cooper must have felt. I wanted to be able to sell that way, so that no matter what happened or where I was, I could sell. Now, how about you? If you were dropped off in Dubuque, Iowa, a small city on the west bank of the mighty Mississippi River, opposite the Illinois-Wisconsin border, could you make a sale by 5 p.m.? Well, if you're a top 1% club member, you could and you would. That's being self-sufficient. That's being in control of your own destiny. That's being a sales superstar. Now here, meet another one, Jim Hayes. Jim was born and raised not far from Dubuque, in Keokuk, Iowa, one of six kids in a close-knit family where he learned great people skills. I mean, he had to, with five brothers and sisters. Jim's sales career began with selling life insurance for 2 years, and then new home sales when he moved to Phoenix. After 10 years of outstanding sales success, Jim and his wife, Debbie, started their own land and home sales business. One project that was particularly successful was a private water ski lake just outside of Phoenix. That opened the door for them to become owners of a Mastercraft boat dealership in 1990. Well, success had become their habit. Jim and Debbie Hayes were in the top 20% of all Mastercraft boat dealers nationwide in sales and were number one in the company almost every year in customer service. Jim did most of the selling, Debbie sold too, but also ran the business. And even though Jim had a great personality, was very professional, really knew how to read people, had a passion for what he sold, and truly believed that selling is helping, and all of those were great qualities, he was still not yet a conscious, unconscious competent. Jim said he had flashes, brief moments, when he saw so clearly where he was in the selling process, where his prospect was, and what he needed to do next to make the sale. You may have had those flashes yourself at times, and if you're a conscious, unconscious competent, you have them almost all the time. According to Jim, the turning point came in the early 1990s. At that time, I was conducting several national sales seminars for the Mastercraft Boat Company, and Jim had invested in my original set of sales training tapes and was listening to them. That's when he decided to take me out to see that private water ski lake called Lakeside Ski Village in Buckeye, Arizona. There was only one lot left out of the 21 original parcels. With great enthusiasm, he showed me this half-mile-long, 250-foot-wide lake surrounded by desert and tumbleweed, 70 miles from our home in Scottsdale. After a few passes on the ski course and a quick ride around the lake, he told me what it would cost to own a lot. With positive expectancy, Jim closed. He asked me to become owner number 21. Now, here's where that point we talked about earlier comes in. Learning to sell by evaluating how you feel, think, and act when you're the customer, the buyer, the prospect. So I gave Jim an excuse. I said, Jim, you know, I just wouldn't do anything like this without talking to Judy first. Well, Jim acknowledged my objection, smiled, reviewed all the benefits, and kept selling. Now let's stop here for a moment and think about this. You could probably care less about Lakeside Ski Village, ski boats, water skiing, Jim and Debbie Hayes. But you do care about your selling in your life. That's exactly why this story is such an important one for you to hear. Think about it. It's a great example of one of the most difficult kinds of sales ever to make. The product, a water ski lake, never before heard of by the prospect. No real prospect interest. Nothing to really show except the picture of the future. The assurance that someday there would be trees, homes, docks, fish, and perhaps an increase in value. Now think about what you sell. In most cases, your prospects have heard something about your product or your company, or at least the industry that you're in. Well, not in this case. So back to the story. After the summary of benefits and another few closes, each receiving the same objection from me, I have to talk to Judy. Jim and I parted company, agreeing that he'd give me a call the next day. As I drove home the 70 miles to Scottsdale, I had lots of time to think about what I had seen and heard. Now, do you do that when you've left the salesperson? Well, most prospects do, and your prospects are probably doing it too. If you didn't already close a sale or get a commitment from them, they're probably thinking about what you said and what you did. And they're looking for ways to justify their decision, whether to buy or not to buy. The question for you is, what justification did you give them to help make it a buying decision? It would be wonderful if every prospect said yes immediately. But hey, we're talking real world here in this sales program. And as you know very well, every sale is not closed on the spot. The goal is to get the sale, if not at the first presentation, then the second, the third, the fourth, or the fifth time around. And I'm sure you've heard these statistics. Almost every sales training course uses them, and for good reason. They're true. The research was done by the National Sales Association, and this study found out that 48% of salespeople make just one call and then just give up. 25% make two sales calls and then give up. 15% make three sales calls and then they give up. And at that point, 88% of the salespeople have stopped selling. But 12% keep calling on those prospects. And that 12% ends up getting over 80% of the sales. So don't give up too soon. Remember the words of Abraham Lincoln. Things may come to those who wait, but only those things left over by those who hustle. Well, on that long ride home, my mind began to weigh what I saw and heard about Lakeside Ski Village. Positives versus negatives. Price versus value. Reasons for versus reasons against. Bottom line was, no way could I justify buying into a water ski lake built for competitive tournament-type water skiers out in the middle of the desert with not a thing around for miles when our family, even though we were all water skiers, we were strictly recreational-type big lake water skiers. So when I told Judy about it, all we could come up with on the positive side was that it could be a very good investment opportunity. Buy it now, and since it was a one-of-a-kind project, sell it down the road and make a profit. So I was prepared for Jim's follow-up phone call. My answer would be, No. Jim called right on the time that we agreed, and I began my presentation. Oh, you do know your prospects have a sales presentation. They've thought about your offer, proposal, and product, formed a decision, and then they begin to sell you on their decision. So I told Jim that it was interesting, but we were going to pass. No hard feelings here. End of story. Well, most salespeople would just give up and move on to the next prospect. But not the conscious, unconscious competent, and not Jim Hayes. So here's what he said. Joel, just supposing you did buy that lot at Lakeside, what would be the primary reason? Well, I said, I guess only as an investment. Jim replied, good answer. Because it would be a wonderful investment, and here's why. And then Jim, conscious, unconscious, competent Hayes, began helping me. Not selling me on the investment opportunity, helping me see it. Judy and I discussed it again, and we agreed to invest. Jim got the commitment, closed the sale, and set up a time to complete the paperwork. Now, how did that happen? I mean, I thought I had decided no. Suddenly, it was a yes? Well, prospects can change their minds when they see and accept new benefits, just like I did. When I asked Jim later how he was able to get me to go ahead, he just smiled and said, I learned it from your selling program. I learned by listening in my truck as I was driving around. And what I learned was to listen to the customer. Really listen, and they will tell you how to sell them. Joel, you told me to sell the investment, not the perfect skiing conditions, like skiing on flat glass-type water, with no wakes, and only one boat allowed on each lake at a time, not the opportunity to become an excellent skier. None of the reasons I sold the other 20 owners. And that was the day I joined that elite group of conscious, unconscious competence. I knew exactly what to do, and I did it. Well, was Jim conscious, unconscious, competent Hayes just a skilled salesperson, or did he really help us? After many years, our investment at Lakeside Ski Village continues to appreciate. But even more important, water skiing on a tournament course has become a family passion. Our daughters, their husbands, and Judy and I are positively addicted to it. And that's what makes selling so wonderful. Selling is helping. Thank you, Jim. And keep on helping others. Think back now to a sale you didn't make. Could you have given your prospect any additional information that could have produced a different decision? That's what conscious, unconscious competence do. And we're going to talk more about that later. Well, let's stop here for just a moment and clarify a few points about the difference between retail selling and direct selling. In a retail situation, the prospect comes in and surprises the salesperson. This could be in a retail store, an internet site, a phone call coming into your organization seeking some sort of product information or price, or somebody visiting your booth at an exhibit or a trade show. So by retail, of course, we mean the customer seeks out the salesperson or their organization. So often, retail salespeople mistakenly think that they're limited in what they can do to control their own destiny. Sure, they just can't fly off to Dubuque and start selling like Shirley Schmitz. Most retail salespeople work in specific locations, like car or boat dealerships, insurance agency, model homes, or retail stores that sell home furnishings, major appliances, or electronics equipment. Well, there's lots you can do in those situations to increase your sales. Experienced retailers know they can improve their customers' response by controlling their environment. Experts on retail say that shoppers, and we'll call them prospects, move in predictable patterns. They respond to light and color. You may have heard this before, that customers entering a store turn right over 80% of the time. Wide aisles in a store promote the image of exclusivity in the store and help persuade customers to buy high-priced goods. One well-known retailer angles tables in a diamond shape to guide prospects to the right and then straight to a collection of the latest selection of premium-priced clothing, the high-end stuff. Most Disney retail stores do 3 times the sales per square foot of their average mall competitors. One reason is they get their prospects to the back of the store by using a giant video screen animation with songs that are familiar to kids and parents. Once they're ready to leave, customers head for the front exit by walking through a different aisle. And the more they see, the more they buy. If you're in retail, how can you control your environment? What can you do to make your retail situation work for you? A small lawn sprinkler store I've gone to for years does just that. Their service counter is in the back, and you have to pass through all their displays before you can buy anything. Remember, Willie taught us it's the little things that can earn you huge results. On the other hand, in a direct selling situation, the salesperson goes out and surprises the prospect or customer. By surprises, I don't mean sneaking up on them and going, boo! But the salesperson makes the initial contact. It could be what's termed a cold call, although I prefer gold call, because almost any time you're face-to-face with a prospect, something can occur that will be worth gold to you. A direct selling situation is also an account, assigned territory, or a route sales situation, where you call regularly on a predetermined and clearly identified prospect. And the examples that we'll talk about in these messages will apply to both situations. Now, just a word here about the Internet. Since the expanded reach of the World Wide Web in the 1990s to the typical consumer, as well as representing almost every type of business and organization, e-commerce has been growing dramatically. The growth of the auction economy has been explosive. Whether it's a 16-year-old selling a used bicycle or a multinational corporation buying parts for their machinery and equipment, some experts have even said that the Internet and e-commerce will totally eliminate the need for salespeople, because everything will be a commodity. Well, my vote goes with the other experts who say service is still the one deciding factor. Yes, the Internet will be the place for a lot of commodity purchasing, and it will be based to a great extent on low price and speed of delivery. So if that's possible in your business, don't become a commodity. Service can still be the key. You know, years ago, experts said fast food restaurants would cause every full-service restaurant to shut its doors. Hey, I don't know about in your town, but here in Scottsdale, more full-service high-end restaurants are opening every year. Why? People want quality food and service. And sure, at times, those same people want fast food, commodity-type buying. One industry I'm very familiar with, having spoken to thousands of the salespeople for over 20 years, is the insurance industry. Now, if any product is ripe for e-commerce, it's insurance. Life insurance service is usually only needed if you die, or you need to make changes in your policy. Health insurance when you get sick or hurt. Property and casualty insurance when you have an accident or a loss. So why not just look at it as a commodity and just search the net for the lowest premium? Well, many people do, and many people don't. The ones like me, who want a local agent who knows me, my situation and needs, makes it worth the added premium that I'm paying. So yes, I can get lunch for a few bucks in a fast food place, or I can get quality food and service in a fine dining establishment for the cost of 20 fast food meals. Each meets a need. So focus on your customer's needs and decide to add so much service and being of help that you're selling value, not price. Work at not becoming a commodity seller. Verification of this approach comes from a friend of mine, nationally sought-after technology forecaster, professional speaker, and best-selling author, Dan Burris, based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Dan's read on the Internet is that it gives virtually everyone the information. And in the past, information was what salespeople helped spread, what was new, what was hot, what was not. And now, with so much information being readily available to your prospects, what can you offer? You can offer the added value of knowledge, wisdom, and consultative help. Most products need some type of assistance, guidance, training, and support. Dan gave me a very practical example of this in one of his famous quotes. Quote Dan Burris, "To see the future better, think both A and B, not A or B." You see, it's not either your prospect buys from you or buys online. It's that your prospect buys from you and buys online. It's not a bricks and mortar business or an e-business. It's a bricks and mortar and an e-business. An example of that is well-known Gateway Computer. Founded in an Iowa farmhouse in 1985, Gateway's business was strictly filling 1-800 phone orders. Gateway went public in 1993 and became a Fortune 250 company with over 18,000 employees and sales in the tens of billions of dollars. Then as founder Ted Waite began to see the power of the Internet, he added a website and entered the world of e-commerce, selling Gateway online and by phone. But then in 1996, Gateway Country Stores opened. So now there were bricks and mortar retail stores and 1-800 sales and e-commerce. By the 21st century, they had over 250 stores and more were following. And that's just what Dan Burrows said. Think both and, not either or. So as you listen to these ideas, focus your creative efforts on how you can offer non-commodity service to your prospects and your customers. Now, next question. Do you have a planned presentation? Do you like a planned presentation? Have you ever heard a planned presentation? Well, most people would say that they've heard them and they don't like them and they don't use them, right? Well, I'm not so sure about that. Could it be that the professionals have a planned presentation that's so well planned, it's very difficult for you to detect it? My definition of a planned presentation is one that is so well learned that it appears totally natural and spontaneous. By being planned, it permits you to be much more flexible and personalize almost every point for your prospect's needs. When you watch a great actor or actress on the stage, he or she actually becomes the person they're playing, just like Brian Dennehy playing Willie Loman. You know there's a script, rehearsals, and many takes, but when you see it, it's real. When you watch a great dancer, an athlete, or a musician, what they're doing appears so fluid, so natural, so spontaneous, but each is highly trained and has practiced hours and hours. Does this practice pay off? Oh, you bet. Just ask Jeremy Brigham. It got him into the NFL. And Cynthia Cooper, it got her into the WNBA. Is your production increasing every year? Are you getting better every year? Why is a planned presentation so vital? Well, once you've planned your presentation, it becomes so well organized, it appears natural, and it makes sense when people hear it. It gives you confidence, and it lets you listen. You know, experts tell us that it's almost impossible for you to think and listen at exactly the same moment. So if you're thinking of what to say, you're not listening to what your prospect is saying. A planned presentation also helps you think creatively. It gives you predictable results, but most of all, you can repeat it. You know, if you watch a professional golfer on television during an important major tournament, his ball lands in a tough spot, a bad lie. What's he thinking about? His swing? His hands? Keeping his head down? Of course not. He's learned all those already. He's grooved his swing. That's automatic. He's devoting all his thought to the problem and situation at hand. Wouldn't that be a wonderful way to deal with your sales presentations? To have such confidence in your swing that you're not thinking about closing techniques, handling objections, or the questions to use. Those are all automatic. Instead, you're devoting your full attention to your prospect and what he is telling you. So what would you like to add right now to your own selling plan? Better qualifying techniques? Additional closing strategies and closing questions? How about some answers to those tough objections? Or how about some powerful, positive words to add to that plan? As you know, words create pictures. And as a professional salesperson, you can create positive pictures with the words you use. How many times have you heard these words used in a sales presentation? Contract, buy, pitch, deal, sign it, pay for it, price? Well, check your next presentation for any of these negative words and replace them with positive words that create positive pictures. Let me give you an example. Change contract to agreement. Oh, people love to make agreements, but they usually don't like to sign a contract. People don't like to buy things as much as they like to invest in things. Watch out that you don't use that word pitch. As far as I know, only baseball players do that. Professional salespeople make presentations. And deal. Deal may be an acceptable term in some industries, like, you know, have I got a deal for you? But how about improving on it and using the word opportunity? Oh, I have a wonderful opportunity for you. Avoid saying sign it. People are very willing to okay or approve things. How about paying for it? Why not use the phrase arrange for it? And instead of price, use the word investment. Do these words really make a difference, or are we getting just too picky on this? Well, just look at the word sell for a moment. I mean, there's a common word. Have you ever looked it up in the dictionary? Well, let me read to you some of the definitions of the word sell as they appear in my dictionary. First on the list, quote, to deliver or give up in violation of duty, trust, or loyalty. Betray. Now, that's the first one. And there's more. To dispose of or manage for profit instead of in accordance with conscience, justice, or duty. How about this one? Cheat, and it's in bold print. Words are so important. You know, if that's what people have been conditioned to think, it's our job to change that by using powerful, positive words. How do you react when suddenly a prospect says, what's the price? Do you hesitate and think, oh my gosh, I wish they wouldn't have asked me that? What do you say with a big smile on your face? Oh, I'm so glad you asked, Mr. Prospect. That's the best part. Then you describe your product, explain some extra benefits, and then say, and your investment is only $211,560. Then close. Would it be more convenient for you to handle this all at once, or would you rather use our convenient payment plan? Do that automatically. You know, think of the astronauts, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. Years ago, when they trained for that very first Apollo moon mission, they had to perform their tasks perfectly 300 times without making a mistake. They called it simulation training. Mission Control tested them 300 times, throwing problems at them continually, and the astronauts had to respond automatically with the correct procedures. Only when they did it perfectly 300 times did they qualify to go to the moon. And if you remember that first moon landing on July 20th, 1969, nothing went wrong. Then why all the training? Why all our training? Why all this time preparing, practicing, listening to messages like this one, reading books and improving? Not for the easy sales. We don't need the help there. No, it's when we get in those tough situations that we need to have the right answer automatically, and that comes only through practice. How about the 14 words that a Yale University study discovered years ago that were the most powerful? Here they are: advantage, discovery, easy, guarantee, health, love, money, new, proven, positive, results, safety, save, and you. You know, the positive results of this study have been proven. And now you can take advantage of them. Make a conscious effort to use them as much as possible in your presentations. Soon you'll use them unconsciously, and you'll love the new results you'll get. And you notice this, just so easy to use. I mean, I guarantee when you do, you'll be painting better word pictures, making even more sales, and earning even more money. And you might qualify for membership in the top 1% club. I wonder, if you were aware that I just used 10 of those 14 words in that last statement, did you notice them? If not, go back and listen again. You know, with a little effort, you can begin using these powerful words in your presentations. Now, why are techniques like this so important? I mean, you've got a good product. You have an excellent company. Why can't you just say what pops into your mind at the moment? Well, you can. I mean, that's what most salespeople do, the ordinary ones. But things have changed over the years. Your customers are wiser, more sophisticated, more knowledgeable. And they're a lot more skeptical these days. In many cases, salespeople are simply not believed, and rightly so. I mean, think about some of the things that have eroded your trust as a consumer. Major corporations convicted of price fixing and outright fraud, selling products they know to be unsafe. Internet privacy issues, where personal information about you is sold without your knowledge. Corporation presidents indicted for bribery, failure to pay their taxes, and making illegal political contributions, products banned or recalled. Yet because of all of these so-called problems, you have a wonderful advantage. You're a professional. You sell by following scientific rules and principles, and these assist you in overcoming skepticism, negative past experiences, media conditioning, and exaggerated claims of other salespeople. How then can you maximize what you know to get even better results? By having a better plan and then following it. I have a friend who took a speed reading course some years ago. He was really excited about it. At the completion of the course, he showed me his certificate of graduation. The certificate showed that when he began the course, he read at 245 words a minute with a 78% comprehension rate. I mean, that was fairly good. But when he completed the program, he was reading 2,103 words a minute with an 87% comprehension rate. Amazing progress. You know what happened after that? Nothing. You know what he reads today? About 250 words a minute. He had a certificate that proved he could do 2,103, but a few years later he was right back where he started. You know why? He's not using what he knows. You see, it's not what you know, it's what you use that counts. Do you have a step-by-step procedure that you follow consistently? Well, you might be saying, now wait a minute, Joel. My prospects and customers are all different. The situations vary. The conditions change. How can you say I should have one planned approach? Well, you can. And most likely you do. But maybe you haven't realized it. Now, we've agreed that selling is a science. And since it is, we know that there are certain things that must happen nearly every time a sale is made. Now, sometimes we have to do them, sometimes our prospect or customers do, but they must occur before a sale is made. Your prospect needs to answer 6 vital questions before making a favorable decision. Do I want the product? Do I want this particular one? Do I want it now? Do I want to pay the price? Do I want to get it from you? Do I want to get it from your company? Now let me say them a little slower. They're very important. Do I want the product? Do I want this particular one? Do I want it now? Do I want to pay the price? Do I want to get it from you? And do I want to get it from your company? Experience teaches us that with a selling plan, you can help your prospects answer these 6 vital questions. And remember, the prospect is the one that makes the decision. Selling is helping. And none of the techniques covered in this program will enable you to sell anything to a prospect who really doesn't want it. So what then is the best selling plan to use? Well, that's completely up to you. It's your plan. It must be personalized to you. One thing that I do recommend is that you have an outline. An outline that fits your personality, your product, and your market conditions. So let me share a concept that my experience has proven is applicable to nearly every selling situation. Now, just to give you a little background. Before I got into sales, I worked in the construction industry. After high school and a 2-year technical training course in building construction, I worked as a carpenter, draftsman, estimator, surveyor, and assistant construction superintendent. My entire source of income prior to sales was building things and working with my hands for over 5 years. But once I got into sales and made a transition from building buildings to building a sales presentation, I kept the same approach. In construction, you have a set of plans. Yet, you run into unplanned for situations in soil conditions, or the building owner's changing needs or wants. And you have to be flexible. You have to redesign those original working drawings and issue new ones. My boss, tough old Julius Ozzarell, a longtime professional contractor for over 50 years, would constantly stress this point. He'd say to us, get the foundation laid out perfectly, and the rest of the building goes up a lot easier. Make a mistake in the foundation, and the job is filled with problems from there on. I never forgot those words. And you know, Mr. Ozzarell was right. So now visualize the construction of your own sales presentation, working off a carefully designed set of working drawings. First, your professionally built sales presentation begins with a solid and true foundation. Visualize in your mind's eye a building block placed on the top of this foundation, and another block next to it, and so on. We're going to build a pyramid of ideas with 10 building blocks. Each block or idea must be placed on the foundation in a logical order. And what does that foundation consist of? Preparation. Knowing your prospects and what they're interested in. Organizing and customizing your material to your prospects' needs and wants. Putting yourself in the prospect's shoes and asking yourself, what would I like to hear? Remember, thinking like a customer. Keeping your material channeled into your prospect's mental radio station, WIIFM, what's in it for me? And finally, clarifying your own thinking, asking yourself before each presentation, what am I going to accomplish? How will it benefit my prospect? And how can I be most effective? And think how much it would help you improve if you were just even a little bit more prepared. Now, you may already be using a simpler version of the building block concept, with maybe just 3 blocks, perhaps an opening, a body, and a close. Or you might be using that old 4-step ADA formula. A stands for attention, I for interest, D for desire, A for action. But the concept that I'm going to share with you has 10 building blocks in that pyramid shape, stacked 4 layers high on a solid foundation. The first layer is 4 blocks, the second layer is 3 blocks, placed on top of the first 4. Then layer number 3 is 2 more blocks, and finally, layer 4, 1 final block. So let's start with your first layer and building block number 1, the pre-approach. That's what your prospect knows about you before meeting you. What he or she has heard about your product, your company, from your website, your brochures, the industry, association sources, or maybe a pre-approach letter, a phone call, your ads, your reputation. In a retail situation, it could include the condition of the parking lot and the front door. Now, building block number 2 is the approach. That's the first impression you make on your prospect, those first 7 to 15 seconds when they form their first impression. And remember, there's no second chance at a first impression, except if you're Willie Cooley. Almost everything about you is communicated. Your attitude, your confidence, your sincerity, and your level of expectancy. Also, check your appearance. Check your materials and check the time. If you have an appointment, be there ahead of time, like Willie Cooley. Remember, if you're not early, you're late. Now, building block number 3 is attention. You must capture your prospect's attention quickly. Now, here are a couple of specific techniques that can help you do that. Stating your purpose. Mrs. Garrison, the only purpose I have in coming in to see you today is to ask you 2 questions about your business. Or you can mention a benefit. It'll take me 3.5 minutes to show you an idea that could save you and your company over 362 hours in lost productive time in the next 16 days. Did you notice in that last one the use of no round numbers there? So much better than the ordinary. You know, it'll take me 5 minutes to show you an idea that could save you and your company over 300 hours in lost productive time in the next 2 weeks. Hey, be creative, be unique. How about making a promise? I promise you, I'll be here only 4 minutes unless you ask me to stay longer. Then take off your watch, put it out so your prospect can see it. Or how about paying a compliment? Oh, you know, your receptionist is so professional and so nice to everyone who calls or comes in. What an asset to have somebody create such a good first impression. Boy, you sure hired right. Now, that better be sincere, or don't use a compliment. It could backfire on you. How about the idea of arousing curiosity? You could say something like this. You'll be so glad you didn't see me last week when I stopped by. Now, think of those specific examples so far. What's the principle here? You must get your prospect's attention. How about that one about arousing curiosity? The prospect should be thinking, why are they glad about not seeing me last week? Now, of course, you better have a good reason. A price decrease just went into effect. A new product was just released. How about showing a dramatic exhibit? Let's say you walk into a prospect with a covered box, like it's a surprise for somebody, and quietly say, only 12 people have seen what's in this box. Now, what would they be thinking? What's in the box? Who are the 12? Why only 12? In any case, you've got their attention. How about asking a question? I mean, this is a great attention getter. How is the XYZ system you got from us last year working out? Just a simple question. How about offering to be of service? Your assistant called the other day with a question, and I now have a complete answer. Should I go over it with you or with her? Or how about making a startling statement? Not a single bank existed anywhere in the 13 colonies before the American Revolution. Anyone needing money had to borrow it from an individual. Today, our bank, right across the street, is coming to you with money. How much would you like? Now, creative if you're with a bank, or if you sell pharmaceuticals. How about this startling statement? Pierre and Madame Curie refused to take out a patent on the process of making radium. They believed it belonged to the world. Our researchers have just come out with a wonderful new product that we too felt belonged to the world. We have taken out a patent on it, and that's why I'm here. Now you've got their attention. Or how about using a referral? You know, the only reason I stopped by is that I promised your friend Larry McCain that I'd show you this idea. Now, those are some examples just to get you thinking. How can you quickly and positively grab your prospect's attention and have them focused on you? Now, let's stop and think about what happens next after you've made your approach and captured the attention of your prospect. And that's where building block 4 comes in, qualifying. Finding the need or the problem. You can't offer your product as a solution to the problem until you probe for what they need. And in message number 5 of this program, we're going to cover qualifying in so much more detail. Now, the next 3 building blocks, 5, 6, and 7, form the second layer of your pyramid. These are interest, conviction, and the desire steps. They are the body of your sales presentation. In these 3 steps, you'll use a technique called the unit of conviction, and that's coming up in much more detail later on in the program. As a result of the qualifying you did in building block number 4, you've identified the need. And now you present your product as the solution and build your prospect's desire to take action. The more prospect involvement here, the better. In this phase of your presentation, watch out for shop talk or buzzwords, words that apply just to your industry. Now, I mean, you know them, but the prospect might not. Make sure you use terms that are clear to your prospect. Now, building block 8, the resolve to invest now. Here's where you create the urgency that now is the time to act. Have you ever received this objection? You know, gee, it really sounds great, but, you know, why don't you get back to me in a couple of weeks? There's no urgency. And later on in this program, we're going to cover ways to handle that specific objection. Building block 9 is the action step, closing for the decision. You do that by using physical action closing techniques, such as handing something to your prospect, writing something down, or assuming with positive expectant actions that the sale is made. And building block 10 is the sale. That's the top of the pyramid. Your prospect wins and becomes a customer, or an account selling continues to be your customer or client. And after the sale is completed, be sure to do what the ordinary salespeople forget. Arrange for a service call, ask for an evaluation, and then conclude your presentation with something extra. You see, they've already made the decision based on what you've told them. Now give them more. Promise a lot, deliver even more, like Willie Cooley's side trip to Graceland. It's that little extra that can prevent buyer's remorse and make all the difference in keeping the sale solid. Clearly visualize in your mind these 10 building blocks. You may want to use the idea that one top producing salesperson came up with after she heard this concept. She covered a wall of her office with cork and actually built a presentation, visually following the building blocks. For each block, she tacked up a large piece of paper, and on it, she outlined what she said and what she did in each one of the steps. Every time she got a new idea or improved on an old one, she added it to that block. Now, another top producer used a notebook with 10 pages, each representing a building block. And every time he made a presentation, he added a note. His goal on each presentation was to improve one of those 10 building blocks. Now, you can do the same thing on your computer as well and build the pyramid. A lot of work? Sure it is. Profitable? What do you think? What would happen to your closing percentage and sales volume if you knew exactly where you were and where you were going in every sales situation? You'd also improve faster if you kept better records. Know your closing percentage. How many contacts result in how many presentations? And of those, how many sales do you make? As one sales rep said when his manager asked him about his week, he said, "Well, Monday was a pretty good day. I made a sale. Tuesday, I didn't sell anything. And Wednesday, the guy I sold on Monday called up and canceled. So you might say that Tuesday was my best day." No, seriously, records are important. But you got to know where you are and where you're going. As Yogi Berra once said, "If you don't know where you're going, you'll probably end up someplace else." It's vital to know your direction. The person with a better plan, who's well prepared, is much more likely to succeed. So here's what you can do. I made a list of 10 action things. Let me read them to you. Number 1, study selling as a science. Invest the time. Number 2, determine what stage of development you're at. Number 3, recognize and overcome the customer's negative conditioning. Number 4, use positive, powerful words. 5, prepare like a professional. Work on the things you're responsible for. 6, plan your presentation and adapt it to each prospect. Number 7, construct your presentation using the 10 building blocks. 8, start a file on selling ideas and keep adding new concepts to your plan. 9, study and observe other salespeople. Analyze their actions, critique their strengths and weaknesses. And then number 10, keep listening to improvement programs like this one. If years ago you found yourself in Memphis and needed a taxi, who would you call? Top 1% club member? Willie Cooley, of course. And if you were interested in a water ski lake in the Arizona desert, who would you call? Jim and Debbie Hayes of the Top 1% Club, of course. And if a customer or prospect needs your product or service and wants a true sales professional, who will he or she call? The answer should be you, because you are in the Top 1% Club too. Now go out and make it a great day and sell it with the $1 Million Attitude.